I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to Alternative Outlook. Other news sources read from a news feed in their skyscrapers. Alternative Outlook is on the ground, where people speak for themselves, producing an alternative narrative rarely heard in the mainstream media.
We also provide a platform for intellectuals who question the establishment while offering solutions ignored by those in power. Alternative Outlook is about building solidarity through illustrating the interconnectedness of struggles throughout the world and revealing a consistent, unifying struggle and theme, resisting the inherent exploitative nature and systematic shortcomings of capitalism.
I'm James Simmons. This is Alternative Outlook. Welcome to episode 16 and the 1 year anniversary of this radical news podcast that is on Pirate Radio in Colorado and Oakland, California, as well as a podcast on the internet. This episode, episode 16, will include a report back from media professor and critic Dennis Breaux of Long Island University at the Cannes Film Festival. It's the third installment and final installment. We will have a fast food workers update from New School University economist Richard Wolff. We'll have a news segment on Canada's Grassy Narrows First Nation demanding government action after 50 years of mercury poisoning. We have an interview with the co-founder of the Food Not Bombs movement, Keith McHenry. We have a news piece on a fair food rally for Immokalee workers against Wendy's. And we also have an interview with homeless liaison for the Allentown, Pennsylvania school system, Russell Rooster Valentini. So we're going to start things off with the interview of Keith McHenry, co-founder of the Food Not Bombs movement.
Yeah, so Food Not Bombs is a global all-volunteer movement that collects food that can't be sold and makes vegetarian meals that we serve on the streets in about 1,000 cities. And it started in Food Not Bombs in 1980 in Boston. And it's also been involved in other actions besides feeding the hungry and homeless. It's participated in providing meals to tent city protests, things of that nature. We provide the meals at the Orange Revolution and Kiev, and we also coordinated the food distribution for the survivors of Hurricane Katrina.
So you said at one point you were homeless yourself?
Yeah, I've been homeless 5 separate times. The original time I was homeless when I was a young man in Boston, I had gotten hepatitis, and when I was well enough to leave, my roommates evicted me, and I ended up living on the streets of Boston in the snow until I found actually a ride to California, and I ended up living out in Malibu for a while.
Do you feel that lack of education is a primary root of homelessness?
I don't think that that's the primary root of homelessness, but it's certainly a contributing factor. I know in the years that I've been providing food to people living on the streets and hanging out with people living on the streets, a huge number of people cannot read and write. And that makes it really hard for them to get jobs, even jobs that don't require, in the final analysis, reading and writing. But in this society, people should be able to read and write. So I think that is a key problem in this country.
How often does substance abuse seem like a major cause?
Well, substance abuse, I think, is really misunderstood in the homeless population. So I think that a certain percentage of people were abusing drugs or alcohol, and because of that, ended up on the streets. But a huge number of those people, my brother was homeless for 25 years. He didn't get diagnosed as bipolar until the end of those 25 years of living on the streets, and he self-medicated himself out of total frustration as to not understanding his medical condition. So if he had proper health care 25 years earlier, he may have not spent over 2 decades living on the streets. Another problem is a lot of people living on the streets end up turning to drugs and alcohol as a way to cope with both the environmental conditions of having to live in freezing cold situations, or out of because they're hanging out with the community of people and they're trying to build solidarity. And so I found a lot of people that live on the streets and actually didn't abuse drugs and alcohol until after they became homeless, and then started to find that was a coping mechanism that made a certain amount of sense. But then another thing that is really crucial to understand is so many homeless people are not actually abusive of substances, that they are just, it's very similar to the rest of the population, that many people are completely clean and sober, maybe even attend AA meetings while living on the streets if they had been addicted to something before, or it just never even occurred to them or interest them to abuse drugs and alcohol at all, and that's just not part of their worldview. So many homeless people actually even hold jobs in the United States, and some hold jobs that take up like a substantial number of hours of their week, some 20, 30 hours a week, and yet they can't make enough money to actually get the deposit together to rent a place, those kind of problems. So it's not like that all homeless people are drunks and alcoholics. Many of them are, many people living on the streets. I didn't use any drugs or alcohol when I lived on the streets, and I didn't generally hang out with people that used drugs and alcohol when I lived on the streets. And it's just, I didn't have the money for that, the resources for that. Wasn't my interest. I didn't think it helped in any way. So, my interest was actually on, I spent my money actually on paying for the monthly dues to the YMCA, so I would have always a place to take a shower and clean up and stuff like that. And that's where I put my resources. And I know a lot of people on the streets do that as well.
What are some of the biggest preconceived notions about the homeless that you think are false?
Well, I think one of the biggest notions is that the homeless really want to be living on the streets, that they think that somehow that they're basically lazy, that this is a way to get one over on people. Another thing is that people, I think is a big misconception, is that if they really just pull themselves together, they could get in a place and move off the streets. And it's actually really complicated to get off the streets because of a number of different reasons. And one of them is that the programs for homelessness don't really make that at all easy. Often, like if you stay at a shelter, it's like either 7 days or 15 days or something like that, so that by the time you get your, you're trying to get a job, you're already can't get a job because you've already left where the people could leave messages and so on. And so another one is that homeless people don't work. I think that's like a huge percentage of American homeless people actually do have jobs, and they just can't make enough money from their jobs to actually rent a place. Another is that that homeless people are always uneducated, and I've actually met many college graduates, people even with PhDs, former owners of relatively large companies who are living on the streets. I've met college professors that lived on the streets who were like blacklisted because of the McCarthy era and ended up like never being able to get another job again, those kinds of things. So I think it's really a myth that homeless people don't want to work and that homeless people aren't working. In reality, those two things are not true. And then the final one, I think, is that all homeless people are drug addicts and alcoholics, and if they just straightened up and stopped using drugs, they could get a place to live. And I find that a huge percentage of homeless people actually don't, barely drink at all and never use drugs, and that this is not really, so prevalent as people believe.
Do you feel the issue of homelessness receives adequate coverage in the mainstream media?
I don't think so. I don't think that the media in the United States discusses the issue of homelessness or provides any real clues to the reality of homelessness. And its pattern of how it treats homeless people is also quite predictable. For instance, there'll be a period where the media has almost all of its attention on how the homeless are causing a blight on our society, that we don't want to see them, that this is a, you know, a big problem, that we should try to do something so that they're hidden. But at the same time, you then and then you'll have a temporary spike of sort of positive homeless stories. So recently, there's been a little bit of information come out about, you know, I saw like some reports on mainstream TV where they interviewed the current homeless people caused to be homelessness because of the foreclosure crisis. And that kind of makes a little bit of, you know, a sense, but that will probably die out shortly, where then these will be the bad homeless that we don't want to see on the streets anymore. So I did find, like, you know, recently there was one report where it pointed out that in states all across the United States that as many as 20% of all public school kids are homeless. Or in the case, and with this one report, they pointed out 32% of the people attending public schools, children attending public schools in Michigan were homeless. So every once in a while you get like this actual information, but it's very, very rare.
What does your job entail, your day-to-day duties?
My work with Food Not Bombs is essentially a couple of things. One, in my local organization in Taos, I collect food from the grocery stores, from the bakeries. Then I help like organize it so that it, you know, that the best, you know, the stuff that's edible is put away in the refrigerators and so on. And then I help like cook the produce, you know, chop the vegetables and make fruit salad. And then I have take all the equipment out with my volunteer, you know, my other friends to the plaza and serve food. The other thing that I would do is I volunteer at the Taos Peace House. And so all afternoon, people come by looking for food. And sometimes it totally reminds me of like images of Steinbeck or something, because there'll be like a whole family just standing outside the door asking if we have food. And they look like they, in many cases, haven't had food for 2-3 days. We're like, you know, supposedly a better off part of the world, although our county, Taos County, is actually a very poor community. So people don't realize that hunger and homelessness is at such a magnitude in our town.
This is Bro on the World Film Beat with my concluding report on Cannes this week on films outside the main competition. Actually, sometimes the most interesting films in the festival, although often these are films of directors who do not have the global reputation of those walking the red carpet. The three areas outside of the main competition are Un Certain Regard, which I must admit this year was not all that exciting as a category. The films looked a lot like the slew of American independents that are released, at least in New York, every week. Mostly depoliticized, highly personalized films emphasizing ultra-sexual identities, and as in the case with much of the contemporary American independent cinema at the moment, just so much navel-gazing. The one film I missed I would have liked to have seen in Un Certain Regard, the number two category after the major competition, was Charlie's Country from Australia, where longtime Aboriginal actor David Gopalil won a prize for his acting in a film about whether, as an Indigenous among whites, he can go home again, or if indeed there's any home left to return to. A must-see when it opens, as hopefully many of these films will later this year in the U.S. I did see the majority of the films in the next category, Quinze ans de réalisateurs, or in English, the fortnight of directors, or in American, 2 weeks of auteurs. And in this category, which prizes itself on getting newer directors the exposure they need to move up a notch at the next festival and to begin to be world names, there were several interesting films, and almost all with a social import, and one masterpiece. The films were re-shown immediately after Cannes at the Forum des Images, some with the directors in attendance, and this proved a terrific place for me to catch up on films I missed at the festival. The first film I'm going to talk about is The Tale of Princess Kaguya by Isao Takahata. And it's the one unequivocal masterpiece, I believe, in this year's festival. Not only a grand ecological argument for the wonders of nature over and against the corruption of what can be read as a materialistic, power-mad, ecologically terrifying society, but also in the process, in its animation, a summation of 300 years of Japanese painting. The director, Isao Takahata, is Miyazaki's partner in the anime studio Ghibli in Japan, and each have recently completed their last films. The princess of this film's title comes from the moon and is found by a woodcutter. She loves nothing but to be in nature from where she sprang, but is whisked away to the court to become an imperial princess by the woodcutter, whose idea of fame and status is in constant conflict with her reverence for the earth. She tricks her court suitors, exposes the emperor himself as a man with no morals and his attempting to use his status to take advantage of her, and can sadly reunite with the boy she grows up with only in their mutual fantasy sequence. The animation is very stark, like Japanese scroll painting borrowed from the Chinese, which the film acknowledges by having Princess Kaguya unroll a scroll in her chambers. A wild flight of fancy with bilious black brush strokes in a frenzy of zigzagging lines is used to suggest the princess's dream. The last scene with her being reclaimed as a moon goddess recalls the heavenly piece at the end of D.W. Griffith's Intolerance from 1916, which means that in summing up at the end of his feature career, Takahata invokes the beginning of the feature in a film whose thematic is also that of respect not for the earth, but for its peoples. Next up, I'd like to talk about National Gallery. Frederick Wiseman is enjoying a bit of a revival. That is, his films, which examine the inner workings of institutions, have assumed a bit more relevance after his last film, At Berkeley, used the style not for a bureaucratic dissection of the university, but to show how all facets of this elite but public school are grappling with the new reality of how to survive in a California educational system that is deteriorating because of the budget cuts prompted by the bankers' economic crisis. This latest entry contains a hint of that previous thematic. Britain's National Gallery, its largest public museum, is suffering the David Cameron budget cuts, and there's a fascinating debate in the museum, which we watch, between a cross-cutting manager of the purse strings who is cutting back on all kinds of expositions and a curator who accuses the cost cutter of cutting back too much. Mainly, though, this film is about, as John Berger termed it, ways of seeing. Ways the various museum personnel have for displaying the paintings and making them relevant for its largely untoured audience. We watch processes of restoration, hear curators talk about exhibits, but mainly listen to tour guides who are passionately rapturous about the paintings and make them come alive. This is a fascinating 3-hour tour of the museum. But who we do not hear from, but occasionally kept a glimpse of, are the largely minority guards and museum personnel who ought also to have been included for their probably very complicated perspective on this culture, which they are paid minimally to protect, and which is mostly not their own. Next up, to contemporary noirs from Korea, A Hard Day, where a South Korean cop begins his day on the way to his mother's funeral by running over someone whose body he immediately conceals. And this is Shades of Otto Preminger's Where the Sidewalk Ends from 1950. But that film's midpoint is only the opening moment for our Korean cop, who in the end, though we assume him to be a murderer who covers up his crime, is the most honest, most heroic, and most compassionate member of the police force in a comic noir which grows ever darker in terms of its exposure of official corruption. The film by Song Hun Kim puts its character through the ringer, where he is ever more brutalized by his superior, while also exposing the cop himself as a brutalizer who dangles a suspect from the roof of a building and interrogating him. One of the most fascinating aspects of the film, similar to other South Korean policiers like The Unjust, is that the evil almost entirely springs from the cops and their endemic corruption. Drug dealers and the like, rather than dangers to the society, are seen as pawns in the cops' ever more brutal movement up the social ladder. The most startling film of the festival is not a film at all, but rather a television series, Petit Kian Kian, or Little Can Can, by the well-known French auteur director Bruno Dumont. The series, shown out of competition in the Canzon, is the third major series to grace the Croisette, and since it is a move into the medium by a distinguished director, represents the new respectability of television, recognized in France as in the U.S., as no longer a form languishing in the vast wasteland, but the new arena of mid-level serious film production. The title of the film is a pun, a different spelling that sounds out as can-can, the French dance revived under de Gaulle as a sign of nationalism and the subject of a film by Renoir of the same name. This film is about the dark heart of the French rural South, the spirit that gave rise to the recent victory of the National Front. A local cop in Normandy investigates in 4 episodes the ever-escalating murders of locals whose bodies are found sewn into bovines, while a band of rural youth, led by little Can-Can, rage savagely at African kids in their village. The series, as does Dumont in general, indulges a bit too much in the sadism of its more than misspent youth, but it does in a way that compares to Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon, lay bare the spirit of French fascism. There is one transcendent moment. At a funeral of a classmate, a very mediatized teen for whom little Can-Can is amorous, steps up onto the altar in the church and sings a completely unrelated song, not in French but in English. It functions less as eulogy than as her tryout for a sort of French idol. The series veers into David Lynch's Twin Peaks territory, but this moment, where her attempting to grab the spotlight is spectacularly unrelated to the death of her fellow teen and simply about her own media potential, harks back to that equally transcendent moment of the Roy Orbison song Crying, sung in Spanish in Mulholland Drive. In its sublime crystallization of the toxic effects of an alienated stardom, surpasses it. Finally, 2 other films, in a way, are about the economic crisis which plagues France as well as the rest of Europe. We get in Bonne de Fille, or let's call it Girls in the Hood, a look at the treacherous path down which a bright, talented girl of African descent must trudge if she is to be successful. And in Mange tes morts, or Eat Your Bones, but more literally and probably appropriately, Eat Your Dead, we are privileged to the inner workings of a band of Roma, gypsies, who are in the process of cultural acculturation that is presented as both necessary and sad. Both films are interesting attempts by French directors to go inside a more closed society, but neither is free from some cultural pandering as well. Bonne de Fille is the second film by Selina Siama, and the opening recalls her first film, Tomboy, as we watch a football game presented with the full ESPN heroic treatment, except that we slowly discern the players are women. This best sequence in the film ends with the Afro and French women from both teams crowding around and congratulating each other. Then the lead character, the quarterback, who threw the winning pass in the game, leaves this more working-class formation and joins a more Americanized gang of girls who wear leather and listen to American rap and R&B, in one scene all lip-syncing to Rihanna's Diamonds. The lead character, though, eventually leaves this band and enters the world of drug couriering and prostitution in a cautionary tale that presents this as the inevitable end of anyone trying to get out of the banlieue, the French suburbs, equivalent to America's inner cities. The film reminds one a bit of Alison Anders' much better My Vida Loca about Latina gangs set in the Echo Park section of Los Angeles. This film ultimately succumbs to its own love of the American culture, which is, as is acknowledged here, not creating an identity, but breaking down the working-class solidarity of the girls in the opening football game. Mange tes morts, Eat Your Bones is a look inside a particular Roma sect that centers around the relationship between an adopted teen on the eve of receiving his baptism, since the Roma are slowly merging with a Christian sect in their trailer park, and his older brother, who returns on the day before from 15 years in prison for killing a cop. There's an elegance in the desperation of the older brother, who takes 3 of them out for what they call a night of wild adventure, which of course ends up in tragedy, all of them risking their lives over siphoning off gas at a local dance club that they do not have the money or means to attend. There's an aphasia quality in the sacrifice of the ex-con brother for the rest, and a sense of this life is passing that unfortunately is also problematic because the Roma ways, anarchic, outside the law, dangerous and destructive as they are century-old ways of coping with being in a perpetual economic crisis. And the film does not truly point to an enduring life beyond, only a conventional one. At the bottom of the canzon is Refugiado, or The Refugee, by the wonderful Argentine director Diego Lerman, whose Ton de Repente, or Suddenly, which overthrew class and sexual boundaries, was one of the great and revolutionary moments of the new Argentine cinema. The current film is a paint-by-the-numbers story of a woman beaten by her husband, which is a formidable topic, but unfortunately here the only theme of a film that has nothing new to say about the subject, which locates it in no broader context involving Argentine society as a whole, and is, in the end, not even as suspenseful as the Julia Roberts vehicle sleeping with the enemy, and that's saying something. This film joins films like Cannes jurist Pablo Trapero's Carancho, as failed attempts to reinvigorate a cinema that now seemed, after its heyday in the early part of the last decade, tied to the economic crisis in Argentina, to be stagnating. I'll conclude with my prize for the next level of competition, the Semaine de la Critique, or Week of the Critic, a competition founded in the wake of Godard Truffaut's protest in Cannes in 68, which helped initiate the student revolt that same month. The film, also shown in the next week in Paris at the Cinémathèque, which played a part in the 68 protest, is called Hope by Boris Login, about the relationship formed on the run between a Cameroonian man and a Nigerian woman as they attempt to get out of Africa into Europe. The film has a number of points to make, among them that the artificial African boundaries of the colonial countries continue to impede Africa, but also have been superseded by a global exploitation and gangsterism, which, as the film shows, can still be combated by African fellow feeling, which the two exhibit toward each other. The film also recalls and situates itself within the three great aesthetic moments of the contemporary Middle Eastern and African migration to Europe. Michael Winterbottom's In This World, about Afghani and Pakistani refugees, the African film La Cigale, which centers on the journey in the tiny boats and the perils of the open sea, and the Bande Dessinée, or graphic novel, at the Venice Biennale in 2007, depicting an African compared to Camus waiting in Morocco to cross to Europe. The film is gripping, touching, and in the end devastating about the effects of this journey. Both actors are superb, and in the end, Hope, also the name of the female Nigerian, though overtly containing nothing of the sort, will restore anyone's faith in the ability of the cinema to make us feel, and hopefully, to act, to thwart the increasing injustices that world corporate globalism is always busily organizing for us. This is Bro on the World Film Beat. I'll be back at the end of the summer with reports on both the Venice Film Festival and the Venice Architectural Biennale. And until then, la lutte continue dans les arts et dans le monde. The struggle continues in the arts and in the world. A bientôt.
Okay. I guess I just have one question since I haven't seen any of these films. Have you noticed in this great body of work any larger trends cinematically, socially, politically, economically, or culturally down the line?
Well, I did comment the first week about films of about the war, but they didn't totally impress me. As I said, I found them to be a very mixed bag. I think what I've noticed is that filmmakers are perhaps dealing a little bit more at a micro level, but they are very interested in all these sort of inequalities, like, you know, Mange tes morts, bande de filles, you know, the inequalities of the Roma, which are sort of amplified and in some way perhaps become everyone's inequalities, the inequalities of the girls in the hood, you know, which become perhaps more universal. Of course, we do have, I think, in Princess Kaguya, an unbelievably trenchant statement about the destruction of sort of the material impulse versus the natural impulse. And it's so well done, you know. So I think filmmakers are focusing on specifics to try to say sort of general things. And as I've tried to show here, you know, in Hope, in this journey across Africa with the Cameroonian woman and the Nigerian man, and the way they get together, the way they come together to talk about both the unbelievable struggle, but also the potential hope that exists in that struggle. And I think they're finding sort of micro ways to talk about these larger questions, which are sort of macro questions. And I think, as I've tried to show, that they're doing an excellent job of it in many cases.
A delegation from Ontario's Grassy Narrows First Nation traveled to Toronto this week. 50 years ago, a massive amount of mercury was dumped in their water supply, and they've suffered ever since. They say the government has ignored their needs, and they're demanding action. Aaron Hudson reports from Toronto.
More than 50 years ago, a paper mill dumped 20,000 pounds of mercury into the river system surrounding the homelands of Canada's Grassy Narrows First Nation. Ever since, the people downstream have suffered the effects of mercury poisoning, including tremors and loss of muscular and sensory control. Grassy's former chief, Steve Faubister, is in constant pain due to his exposure to mercury.
You lose your coordination, your speech, and you die in your body breaks down one piece at a time. It's very painful.
He staged a hunger strike this week demanding government action. He described some of the effects of mercury poisoning.
What compelled me was to go on a hunger strike was a young woman came to me, barely 20 years old. He had a son was 1 year old and had developed seizures 6 times a day. Imagine.
The details of how more than 2,000 were poisoned were kept quiet as part of a 1985 out-of-court settlement between Grassi and the Ontario and Canadian governments. The settlement established an independent mercury disability board to provide adequate health care and dispense compensation. According to a report commissioned by the board in 2009, the care and compensation being provided isn't enough. The report admonishes the Canadian and Ontario governments for their conscious inaction, high burden of proof for affected residents seeking compensation, and for those who do receive compensation, the comparatively small amount awarded. The report was quietly released in 2010. So quietly, many Grassi residents, many of whom are living with disabilities caused by the mercury, didn't even know it existed until this spring, including current chief Roger Faubister.
Being a new chief and being the head of the Grassi Narrows government, I take the matter of mercury pollution seriously. So when that report was mentioned and we decided that let's take this report and talk about it with the government of Ontario.
The board's chairperson told media that a briefing on the report was given to Grassi's board representatives and a community meeting was held. The Ontario Minister of Aboriginal Affairs plans to visit Grassi next week and says he intends to launch an investigation of the board. About 30 Grassi residents are in Toronto this week to stage a series of protests. They're demanding an apology and want the Ontario government to accept responsibility, to provide adequate compensation, and to ensure quality health care for those affected. They also want the polluted river system cleaned up and are calling for a moratorium on clear-cut logging on their territory. The largest action plan for this week is a river run protest, where demonstrators will personify a river marching towards the Ontario legislature. Erin Hudson, FSRN, Toronto.
I'm Rooster, Russell Valentini. I'm the Homeless Educational Liaison in the Allentown School District and for Region 8 in Pennsylvania.
Okay, and we're here in Allentown, and we're going to look at a place where a family that Russell was taking care of was staying. Russell, would you like to tell us the story?
Sure. Earlier this year, there was a family of six that was discovered to be actually living in one of these garages here, actually number 55 here. They had rented the garage because they were unable to afford rent, and they rented the garage, which sounds crazy. However, it was the only way that they were able to keep the family together, since the only family shelter in Allentown has a 2 to 3 month waiting list. They were in this unit, and the children were coming to school every day, and they were clean. We would have never known unless they fell behind on the rent here on the garage. But I gotta tell you, the children were getting washed up with water bottles and wipes, and they were coming to school without any odor, without any knowledge of what their situation was. And that's how resourceful that some homeless families are and how much investment they put into trying not to be discovered. There used to be a pink ribbon, and that's what held the door closed for when the kids came home from school. And the one parent was working, the other parent was laid off. And that is just one example of some of the lengths that some homeless folks go to try to make themselves be able to stay together and take care of their needs. The average age of a homeless person is 9 years old.
9
years old.
Wow.
So it's not somebody like me. They're the visible homeless. They're the ones that are out there for all to see. But it's these families and the kids. And it's not a stretch of the imagination. If you lose your house, it's not a far stretch to think they're going to come and try to take my children from me. And so they are very resourceful, and they, by design, try to stay invisible. And that's the story.
Yeah.
So. Now, also earlier this year, we had a 16-year-old that we found was essentially at nighttime, the nighttime residence was in this tube, this blue tube that is in this playground over here. The student was what we consider an unaccompanied youth, which has become a fast-growing problem. I think back also to when 9/11 happened. It was amazing to be in the shelter when that happened, because here's people that almost that essentially have had everything taken away from them, but they were concerned about the people that were the haves that were losing people and losing things, and that it was amazing. And once again, there I was going down 6th Street, and there was this little old lady, and I stopped to make a visit, and she came out, and she started talking to me, you know, did you hear about this? This isn't so terrible. And I'm actually waiting for her to ask me for a dollar. And she didn't ask me for the dollar, so then I felt like a schmuck, you know. But she was just so concerned about this 9/11 that occurred and stuff. So it's so unbelievable, you know, that people that have every right to just be totally absorbed in their little tiny world are so concerned with the people and things around them and stuff. It's amazing. I was saying before, the kids, I had the girl that used to sing the national anthem at basketball games, this NAACP representative, the student government representative in Allentown, all were homeless students and stuff. So being dumb does not apply any more or any less than the general populace.
What kind of programs or proposals would you suggest for them to combat this endemic?
Well, one thing is, I said before about unaccompanied youth and like the child that was staying for a couple nights in there. One thing would be some kind of interim housing. Now, we have Valley Youth House here in the Valley, and they have a supportive housing program and some independent living, but it's very small. I was out in Minnesota. Minnesota is on a cutting edge for these unaccompanied youth. There's no question about it. We can expand it a lot and try to help. So I think some interim stuff that you're working with the child, that they're not just shaking the dust off. So some stuff like that. Also, teaching the realities of this world, how to do a lease, how to rent a place so that people aren't blowing up, how to budget, though sometimes we're talking about budgeting negative money, but I think really some stuff, and it should start in the schools, you know. If you're not, well, even if you're going to college, let's do a half year or something like that of real things. How do I buy a car? What do I look for? Going in to get an apartment, what do you look for? What should you do? You know, some basic stuff that's like that. And also I'm going to tell you this. This just blew me away. This guy called me up yesterday because he needed Pampers for his baby. He went to a place where they give out Pampers. However, he would have had to sign up for a parenting program. For God's sakes, he's out of Pampers. That doesn't make you a bad parent. That's some of the stuff we kind of do to people, and it's mind-boggling.
Do you feel that the issue of homelessness receives adequate coverage in the mainstream media?
Yes and no. It receives coverage, but it's really the visible homeless that tend to get the coverage. It's that the homeless guy in a park, you know. It's the people with the signs, homeless who will work for food. It's they get the coverage and stuff. But like I was saying, many, many of these folks, they want to remain invisible. They're not wearing homelessness. They're not even saying they're homeless. When I talk to people, I try to dance around that word, because people will not freely admit it and stuff. So I don't want that we start intruding into folks' world, because it's an underground, and they're a very tight-knit group. It's amazing to I feel privileged to be allowed into these folks' lives. But so, yes and no. I don't want them exposed. I don't want them to be exploited. But in the same token, when I do talks or presentations are out there, I want them to know about these kids, that if three kids walked by us now, they might be homeless, but we would never know, because they'll have shoes, they'll have pants, they'll have a coat, and they'll probably, their hair will be in place, because the parents and the guardians or the big sisters or the aunts do a hell of a job making sure that nobody knows what's going on with them.
Do you think that the mainstream media uses negative stereotypes to portray the homeless?
Yes. In some regards, yes. But a lot of that is perpetrated by the government. Like, early on, everything about the homeless, but we were talking about the visible homeless, which is a much higher rate of the mental health, and they garnish a whole bunch of attention. The mental health and the drug and alcohol stuff, that... You don't mention homeless without hearing that in almost the same sentence. It allowed people to stay away from addressing that issue. And so they're not thinking. When you say homeless, you think of someone that's like me or a lady pushing a cart and stuff. You're not thinking about these kids. And once again, average age is like 9 or 10 years old and stuff like that. But they're not visible to us. We don't have, fortunately around here, we don't have someone up a Hamilton Square on a blanket with a baby and a tin cup. But so it's very easy to do that, because the people, the families, and the kids aren't defending themselves, and they don't want to be known.
What does your job entail day to day?
Day to day, I don't know. It's really. I guess every day is to try to do whatever will give the child the best chance to succeed for that day. My main thrust is that these kids can fully participate in school, but I have to pay attention to making sure they have school supplies, that they have hygiene products, that they have food to eat.
All right. Is there anything else that you felt I've missed that you'd like to add?
I really, really feel privileged to work with these folks, and I really, really think that they have a lot to offer, that they're worth the investment, that they're worth putting the time into.
Well, I'm glad the Allentown School District is progressive enough to realize that somebody like you is an attribute.
Well, and actually, and I used to be a truant officer also. But I was chasing the school, and that was one thing that we would find out at magistrate hearings. You know, why isn't your kid coming to school? Well, I've been over in Bethlehem for 2 weeks now because we got evicted and all this stuff. You know, so once I started hitting, and I don't usually say many numbers, but once we hit started hitting like 600 homeless students a year, which is unbelievable. And once again, jeez, they're invisible. You don't see any of them.
Yeah.
So you know, it's very much of a problem. But like when I talk at churches or colleges or different places, you know, and I say that number, they're going, wow. And I said, yeah, but I said, the parent is so committed to not being, you know, exposed. You know, you don't know, you know, you ride by, you just, you don't know.
You know, that family in the garage, if they didn't pay, I'm sure they would have been not there still, you know, today. But if they didn't fall behind in their rent, we would have never known.
Yeah.
Now, here's kids, and they were coming to school for 3 weeks, weren't missing school, getting washed up with water bottles. You know, I mean, it's just, it's simply amazing.
Yeah.
We've had folks in, like, an abandoned building where they go around and they check, or sometimes apartments, a door will be open, and they squat, you know, just like, mm-hmm. and they're in there, and there's no electric or nothing, but they're in there for the nighttime residents and stuff. Prop something up against the door at night and try to make sure that the kids are all right and stuff, you know. People that have been in the vans. Now, they used to have, they cleared this all out, but when we go down a little further across from this Mascaro, they used to call it, you know, Dump City and stuff, but the city took it all apart and stuff. But yeah, up through in there used to be all these dumpsters. Well, there used to be all these shacks and stuff in through there. It might have been, yeah, there might have been 15, 20 in there and stuff. But then they cleaned everything out.
Yeah. See, I've noticed that you get a lot of those tent-type cities in cities, and rather than try to solve the problem, they just break it up and kick them out.
Well, that's one of the differences here now, because they are establishing places for the chronic homeless. The only thing is,
Pulaski's taking a different method.
Well, it's not just breaking up the the play encampments, but the only thing is, you know, even back in time, there was hobos and there was this stew bums and stuff like that. For many people, it is a chosen lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And you know, all in all, if you take a step back, it's not bad. You don't have to pay taxes.
No,
you know,
you're truly free.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you are. And the other thing is, once again, the people are so resourceful. Uh-huh. You're in the winter, in the worst winters, they're not taking a body out, you know, a week, you know, uh-huh. and stuff. They find ways to make it work and stuff like that.
So what is Pulaski doing besides, or instead of just...
Well, they're busting them up, but then they're giving them all these opportunities to go into housing. And
affordable opportunities.
Oh yeah, they're helping them with you know, every aspect of case management and getting them health care, you know, all this stuff. So they've really taken a proactive approach.
You saw the signature Wendy's red braids worn by a group of bikers riding through downtown Denver last weekend. Denver Fair Food in alliance with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW of Florida, are calling on the Wendy's food chain to sign onto the Fair Food Agreement outlined by the Farm Workers' Rights Group. They say that since 40% of tomatoes imported to Colorado in the winter months come from Florida, Colorado consumers should pay attention. KGNU's Irene Rodriguez brings us this report.
Wendy's, shame on you. Farm workers are people too.
Down, down with exploitation. Up, up with the Fair Food Nation. Down,
farm worker alliance organizations such as Denver Fair Food and Astute Farm Worker Alliance want holdout fast food restaurant Wendy's to sign the Fair Food Agreement. The Fair Food Agreement was developed by the Immokalee Farm Workers of Florida, a worker-led movement that is calling for improved working conditions in the fields.
Wendy's, escucha! Estamos en la lucha!
Robert McGoy is a long-term member of Denver Fair Food.
Can you talk about the evolution of the movement from when you first became involved until now?
Sure. The campaign for Fair Food started in 2001 with a boycott of Taco Bell. Ironically enough, at the time, Emil Brolik, the current CEO of Wendy's, was then the president of Taco Bell.
Every year, the CIW holds a major action. Last year, hundreds of supporters marched from Fort Myers, Florida, to the headquarters of Publix grocery chain in Lakeland, Florida, a distance of 200 miles. Several Denver residents participated, as they did in this year's action in Cleveland, Ohio, to Wendy's headquarters. Although Wendy's CEO was the head of Taco Bell at the time the corporation signed the Fair Food Agreement in 2005, Wendy's refuses to sign the Fair Food Agreement under the same management. Robert McGoy.
And that's when I first got involved, was during the Taco Bell boycott. The Taco Bell boycott was successful in 2005, and Taco Bell became the first company to sign a Fair Food Agreement with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. After that, in a pretty rapid succession, companies like McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, Whole Foods, Sodexo, Aramark, Trader Joe's, a lot of other companies. There's a total of 12 companies now in total, including the four major fast food companies plus Chipotle, which is a smaller company, have all signed the Fair Food Agreement. And Wendy's is the only holdout that hasn't signed an agreement with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. So that's why we're out here today, to make sure that all the major fast food companies do join this important program that's already improving the wages and working conditions for farm workers in Florida.
The wage increase would be supported by a premium paid by corporate purchasers of Florida tomatoes and is passed on to the workers in the field. This penny per pound of tomatoes picked would mean that the farm worker wages would meet minimum wage levels. Other elements of the Fair Food Program include the requirement of the growers and purchasers to adopt a code of conduct that includes zero tolerance for forced labor and sexual assault, two problems pervasive in the industry which the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have been able to reduce. The CIW has been able to win the right for employer-paid education sessions for new farm workers, the development of complaint resolution mechanisms, and health and safety committees. And these elements are subject to ongoing auditing. Can you talk about Colorado's role in this?
Yeah, Colorado has always had a unique role and an important role in the campaign for fair food. While the Coalition of Immokalee Workers was going after some of these other major fast food companies and supermarket chains and food service providers, they asked their allies here in Denver and Colorado to target Chipotle, which is, of course, a Denver-based company. So we were putting pressure on Chipotle. We were sending them letters, holding protests, holding marches, holding all sorts of different actions at Chipotle for years and years, trying to convince Chipotle to get on board. And those efforts were eventually successful just a couple of years ago.
Fatima Estrada Rascon.
I go to Regis University.
So I became involved in, like, about a year and a half ago during spring break, when we had, like, the march from Fort Myers to Lakeland. And so we, since then, we've just been asking Wendy's to kind of sign on. The idea is that we thought it was going to be a quick campaign, just because they're the last fast food company that needs to sign on to the Fair Food Program. But Orbalik has been putting up a little bit of a fight, which has been making the campaign extend a little longer.
And is that the CEO?
Yeah. Now, I think a little bit ago, they kicked off the Boot the Braids campaign, where they're going to try to get Wendy's off college campuses. And right now, what we're trying to do here is show support for what folks are doing in Immokalee, Florida, and also what people with Wendy's on their college campuses are doing, and build community around the Fair Food Program here.
I'm John Knutson, and I'm here with Denver Food Rescue, as well as Denver Fair Food. Well, I guess we've taken most of what we learned from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers down in Florida and are trying to implement that here.
What do you want Wendy's to hear today?
We want them to know that it's not just people in Immokalee, Florida who care about these issues, but that it's people all across the entire United States who recognize the problems in one local area.
The group left the Denver Capitol to local area Wendy's, all on bikes, to carry their message. Wendy's managers not only refused to hear the group, but refused them entry into the restaurants.
So what are you here for now?
I'm here with the Denver Fair Food.
Why are you coming in?
Just to speak to the manager.
I'm sorry. I can't allow you to come in, okay?
Can we just give you this letter?
Nope. Sorry. Yeah. Not interested at all. Zero interest.
So we were not able to go in or hand the Wendy's letter. We were told to leave once we got to the door.
So yeah, that kind of shows where Wendy's is at right now.
A little bit louder, three. We want justice for
We're not going to stop until we've enacted some change and until they sign on, because it's really only a matter of time.
Irene Rodriguez, KGNU, Denver.
Start it.
Zombie on the track.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Fast food workers are in the news this last week, the end of July and beginning of August 2014. First was a meeting in a suburb of Chicago that gathered 1,300 fast food workers from around the country, brought together to discuss their strategy in trying to move from the $7 and $8 and $9 an hour level of wages that nobody can survive on to the $15 minimum an hour that is their goal and target and has been of actions now for quite some time. And the interesting thing that was decided at this meeting, which was gathered in part by the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, was a decision reached by these folks representing many parts of the country that they're going to up the ante. They're going to go from demonstrations and petitions and so on to a program that includes civil disobedience specifically and occupying restaurants to make clear that they are determined to get a living, decent income for the work that they do and not to be as exploited as these companies and these employers have imposed on them for a long time. The second thing that affected fast food workers was a ruling by the National Labor Relations Board in Washington, the NLRB, that made a very interesting determination. The determination had to do with McDonald's, one of the largest employers of fast food workers in the world. And the ruling said that McDonald's cannot continue to be exempt from the struggles between workers and employers. What had been done before, and this is typical for many large companies with retail outlets, is that McDonald's took a step back. It created what is known as the franchise system, together with other corporations, been around quite a while, this system. And in effect, what McDonald's does is create a buffer between itself as the company that controls and operates the hamburger empire that it runs, and the actual employer in each case. In that case, in these situations, the actual employer is a local person who owns one or a few McDonald's restaurants. That person is called a franchisee. And technically, legally, that's the employer. But of course, a tight contract connects that employer, the local owner, to the big monster corporation. And basically, if you want to have a McDonald's restaurant, you are bound to do pretty much everything the way McDonald's tells you to do, even though technically you buy from McDonald's the hamburger that you then resell to the retail customer. You buy the napkins, you buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You put up some of your own money, which is nice for McDonald's, and you take a lot of risk that this doesn't work out, which is also nice for McDonald's, and it has other implications. McDonald's can claim it's not responsible for whatever policies the local franchisee imposes on his or her workers. And it is also a peculiar way that messes up the statistics in this country, because each of these little owners is considered a small business. So that you get the idea that, oh, America is a place where there are lots of small businesses. Well, maybe, but these small businesses are in hock up to their eyebrows to a big monster business, McDonald's. They are really not independent. They're really not independent small businesses. The ruling by the National Labor Relations Board is important because it ruled that McDonald's is part of the ownership, even if there's a franchisee between the big corporation and the workers. And the reason that's important is that the struggles of the workers now can be struggles demanding things of McDonald's as a legitimate counterparty to what the union wants. They can't be put away, or the workers can't be put away, by saying you simply deal with the local person. McDonald's wipes its hands. It forces McDonald's into the picture, and that is a major gain for the unions because, of course, McDonald's has the wealth and the power that the workers have always had to confront if they're really going to make a difference.
That concludes this episode of Alternative Outlook. I hope you enjoyed the program. And don't forget to visit us at alternativeoutlook.org. And remember that the revolution begins in the mind of a child.